Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the spice, baby!
Yeah, let's get on that spice goodness. What up? I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Raymond.
I was trying to think of a Dune thing to say, but how's it going, everybody?
Dune. Yeah, okay. And now we got Ryan.
What up, film fans?
And this week we're going to be talking about the film that everybody's talking about, the recently released on, what is it, HBO Max and also theatrical, Dune, right? Now, elsewhere in the world, it hasn't been released yet. So some places, you still got a couple weeks left, but it's coming. I'm sure you'll see it or you'll figure out a way to see it at some point. So yes, this is definitely going to be very spoiler-y. So if you don't want to be spoiled, make sure you put this episode on pause and come back and check it out after you've seen the film. But if you don't care, we're talking about the recently released film Dune, directed by Denis Villeneuve, starring fucking everybody. So we've got Timothée Chalamet, we've got Josh Brolin, we've got Oscar Isaac, we've got Rebecca Ferguson, we've got Stellan Skarsgård, we've got Dave Bautista, Charlotte Rampling, Jason Momoa, Javier Bardem, and apparently Zendaya's in this film as well, I guess. I mean, she's in there for at least a minute and a half, but she's all over the posters, so I guess we can talk about what the deal is with that, since I know a lot of people have been confused about that. But here is the elevator pitch for Dune. Dune is the long-awaited blockbuster adaptation of Frank Herbert's beloved novel. It's set far in the future, where we're thrown smack dab in the middle of a cosmic battle over the precious spice resource that is only found on the planet.
I feel like this is going to be a long elevator ride.
The planet Arrakis, and we follow Paul and his family as they are entrusted with governing Arrakis, the domestic resource, and the locals. That is the elevator pitch, because we're not going to get too much into it more, because we're going to start peeling peeling things back as we get on.
Soon.
Yeah, that's right. As we get on the other side of things here. So first things first, let's talk about first impressions. I don't know if you've seen this film now multiple times, but we'll go around and we'll do some first impressions. I do just want to say, though, before we do that, we are live. So if you are on YouTube and you're listening right now, the chat is live. Please send us your comments, your fan theories, your questions. What do you think about maybe are the film's influences? Do you think it's a good adaptation compared to the David Lynch film from 84, et cetera, et cetera? Comment down below. And then, of course, if you're not listening live, of course, you can email us, you can call us, all that good stuff. You know the deal. You can also follow us on Twitter at SMTM_POD. That's SMT. SMTM_POD. All right, first impressions. Let's start with Raymond. What are you thinking about this film, brother?
Sure. I haven't read the book. I've seen the David Lynch movie, which I think is a good bit of fun. Denis Villeneuve is a fine filmmaker, and I think he's assembled a wonderful cast. I've got no complaints about this movie from a technical standpoint. I think it's really, really well made, but I'm just not all that invested in the characters or the universe. And I think if I read the book, I would probably dig it a bit more. That's kind of my two cents. It doesn't really do it for me, but I'm glad that I know this was like a dream project of his. So I'm glad he's gonna get to make the second part of it. And it seems like from everything I've heard online and seen people talking about, that it apparently is a fairly faithful adaptation, and that the Dune heads are out there are really happy with how it was brought to screen. So I don't know if you guys have read the book. Maybe you'll be able to help connect some of the dots for me.
Well, this is one of those films where there's been a lot of anticipation. They've tried to get the big blockbuster version of this off the ground for quite a few years now. Is this something that you were waiting for? Were you excited about it? Were you invested in the production of this, or did you kind of like take it or leave it?
I haven't watched his Blade Runner sequel either, because I'm not a huge Blade Runner fan. And this one, quite sincerely, and this is not to denigrate the film in any way, if we weren't covering it on the podcast, I probably wouldn't have gotten around to it for years, maybe. Just
interesting.
You know, I'm sure eventually I would do like a Denis Villeneuve marathon at some point to watch all the movies of his that I haven't seen, and I'm sure I would see this and Blade Runner then, but it wasn't really on my radar, but like I said, different strokes for different folks.
Well, maybe if we start peeling back some of the themes, because there are lots of ecological, political, economic, etc., that might kind of open us up to some interesting stuff.
That's why I think I would probably dig the book a lot, because it's I'm on board with what it's doing subtextually, but as far as like, what's going to happen to House Atreides, I'm not too terribly concerned.
I'm going to do the annoying thing, and I'm going to ask you, if you were to give this out of 5 stars, what do you give it?
I think it's a fine adaptation, and it's a for me it's just a totally average movie. It's very, very well made, but I'm, like I said, I'm not that invested in it. So I'd say right down the middle of the road, 2.5 out of 5.
Oh shit, Ryan, you're up.
that wasn't me being mean about it. Two and a half is an average movie.
Okay, Ryan.
So I wanted to see, I was so looking forward to this movie, and I wanted to love it so bad.
Oh,
all right.
No.
And boy, did I not love it.
Oh no.
All, really. I mean, my basic review is essentially like it. Okay. It looked cool for parts of it. It sounded cool for lots of it. I would say the best part is the sound design, I would say. But like in terms of story, yeah, I don't give a shit about anything that's happening. It's as a loyal non-book reader, it was complete gibberish to me. It was complete gibberish to me in parts of it. And yeah, I don't care. I'm not invested in the characters. I thought the costumes, for whatever reason, bugged me, because I was like, all right, this movie costs like $300 million. And to me, it just looks like they just, I don't know, draped a sheet over a bunch of people in the desert. I wasn't impressed by that. The sandworms didn't really impress me. There's like literally, what, 60 seconds of sandworms in this 2.5 hour long movie. So at least I was hoping to get sandworms, you know. There's way more sandworms in the David Lynch movie.
Go see Tremors, okay? Okay, the fucking
classic. Well, I've seen all the Tremors.
I love Tremors.
Yeah, me too.
But, yeah, you put that baseball on a tee for Ryan there, Austin. He has the most Tremors vibe of anyone I know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tremors way above Dune in terms of how much I like it. So, yeah, I was just disappointed in the whole thing. And of course, the elephant in the room, something that I, in my opinion, should be in the United States Constitution that should be made illegal is to, you cannot make half of a movie and charge me a full price for it. I want half of my IMAX money back tonight. Okay. I hate people making half of a movie or half of a story and then saying, come back next year or in 4 years when we greenlight this movie and end up making it, like, fuck that. So that, I have a big problem with that. It's not standalone, and it's not even like kind of halfway, like cliffhanger-y. It's just kind of like literally half a story. Like, they don't fucking wrap up anything.
I will say, in the film's defense, I think there are movies that succeed on those terms, like Lord of the Rings, shot as one production, released as three movies. But I do think that they could have done a better job with this one, like, communicating that through the marketing, that this is Dune Part One, rather than like you go sit down, turn it on, or you sit down, the lights go down in the theater, and then it says Dune, and then it's like Part One. It felt a little bit like a prank. I didn't know that this was supposed to be the first of two halves.
I mean, it was a total bait and switch. They marketed it like, this is Dune. And no, it is part of Dune, right? And I think Lord of the Rings, yeah, kind of what you said, it was marketed as, here's going to be 3 years of Lord of the Rings, and you get every book. And even in that thing that was written, you know, forever ago by Tolkien, it at least, I have the semblance of something was accomplished at the end of each one that made me go, okay, that was, you know, they accomplished one mission or one step, but we got more stuff to do in the next ones. This is just like, well, the same story. Nothing is...
Well, but
anyway,
like,
long story short, I really didn't like this movie, although I did think some parts of it were pretty cool to look at.
Okay,
give him the five-star test to get the chat off my back, Austin.
Out of five, what do you think?
Out of five, I give it 1.5.
Whoa! Damn! Okay, listen, this movie didn't blow me away, but I'm going to have to all of a sudden act like I love this movie more, because I think that the hate in this room, this is salty as fuck right now. Listen,
we can't
have
a bash.
No hatred from me. I'm sorry. I think I'm being painted with a broad brush here. No hatred whatsoever for the film. It's just not my cup of tea.
I wish that I saw this film in theaters, because I think it would be amazing on like some big IMAX screen and stuff like that. So I think I might go see it again at some point. I tried to get tickets to it for the Sydney Film Fest, but it sold out in like 2 seconds. But I'll definitely see it again on the big screen, even though, you know, it's nice in a little home studio back there. But it's not the same, right? And this feels like one of those films that it just is made for the cinematic experience. Like, to me, this is... This is quintessential blockbuster cinematic experience. The cinematography is huge and big, and I love Arrival, and I had a lot of like flashbacks to just the scene when that spaceship is hovering out over that field, and a lot of the stuff even inside when they're getting brought up to it in the forklift, you know, or not the forklift, but the little elevator lift thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you can definitely see Villeneuve's style, his fingerprints all over this. And I was thinking a lot about just the grandiosity of this. And I wish I would have seen it there. So that's one thing for sure that I think about this film that I think is a good thing, because we don't have a lot of those types of big cinematic experiences. We don't get excited about, fuck, let's go to the movies and go to the cinema, right? Now it's just like consume something from your laptop or on your iPhone or something like that. And pity the person who had to watch Dune on their iPhone. Like, I get it. You can do it. There was that meme, that funny meme that's going around about, like, you know, I watched it like Villeneuve intended on my iPhone. And it, yeah, you can't. You got to watch this on something big where the walls are shaking and your head is shaking. I think the color palette is beautiful. I think the cinematography is amazing. I think the special effects are fantastic. I love the dragonfly fucking helicopter things. I thought that was really fun.
Those were cool.
The technology was really interesting, even though I know it's a stripped back technology and there are reasons for this that are rooted in the novel. I really like the kind of post-apocalyptic kind of vibe, very sort of Mad Max-y in a deserted world. Some people are comparing it to A New Hope. That's fine. I kept thinking of Tarkovsky with a lot of things, like Stalker and some of the other kind of like really wide shots that you get in some of Tarkovsky's work, a little bit of Solaris as well, I guess. But I thought the pacing was interesting, and there's some really interesting debates about is it slow or is it supposed to be like prestige sci-fi? And I think there's a really interesting debate there. The acting performances were all good. I know some people kind of joke around about the "they are brutal" line by Josh Brolin, which was pretty laugh out loud, kind of funny. I think the assembled cast is amazing. I don't mind that it's only a partial story. I like an
ellipsis. How dare you?
I like an ellipsis. I'm okay with that. It actually, at one point, I even turned to my girl when we were watching. I was like, oh, it kind of reminds me of the first Lord of the Rings, you know, where it's like you just end with them walking. And I was kind of like, oh, okay, this is totally just a setup. And it just stops you right here. I was okay with that. I actually, though, will say that I don't love the movie.
Shit, Austin, we needed you to love the movie for this podcast.
But I do think this. I think it's such an interesting film. I think there's so many things to discuss, and I think it took a fucking home run swing. And I just think that maybe it was caught at the warning tracks. That's the
metaphor. I could not agree more, Austin.
I'd like to amend my thing a little bit, because while I did trash the movie a lot, I mean, I feel bad for trashing the movie because it is an ambitious big movie with a cool auteur director who I love. And a lot of people in the chat are giving a shit for talking shit about him because they clearly – and Austin, did you say you had read the book or not? Have you read the book?
Yeah.
You have – okay, I'm so glad you read the book, because I wish I had read the book, because I do think this movie is for – people who have read the fucking book. Like, I think that it works the best. All the people that I know who have read it, who saw it, are fucking in love with this movie. And all the people who haven't read it, like me, are kind of like either, yeah, that was cool, or like me, didn't like it. So I do think that you get a lot more into this film if you are out of it if you have read that 3 bazillion page fucking series, you know.
Yeah, so. I've not read all of them.
Really
I've
only digging read the first with both hands now.
I know. I will say this, and this is the last thing we'll say, real quick, and then we'll start peeling things apart. Is I do think that the film doesn't present or express the ecological and political economic themes that the book. Places like front and center, and also the sort of religious mystic, the Sufi elements in particular, which is a smaller sect of Islam, is much less focused on, but it's there obviously, like with names and certain things that I think are so replete throughout the novel and throughout the series that I think it's a little bit of a shame that it's missing. And I'm just going to say this is why I was thinking of Tarkovsky a lot, is the mysticism is there, but because I think Villeneuve was trying to straddle such a difficult balance between blockbuster and people's expectations of how to do a space opera like Star Wars and fucking Alien and everything else that comes along in that subgenre, and then at the same time trying to do like a prestige, methodical, meditative, in my mind, very Tarkovsky-esque type of exploration of mysticism and religion. I think that's a very difficult balance to try to find. And I feel like because he kind of put his film squarely in the middle, it's not enough of one to be perfectly successful in my mind, but I can totally get why people totally gravitate towards it, because it's something that's very different than what we're typically given in sci-fi and also in prestige films. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people will be able to unite around. But of course, we got to give a shout out. We got to pay the bills. So let's run a quick ad here, and then we'll start peeling things apart, and we can really start to piss the fans off. All right. But before we continue, we got to give a shout out to our sponsor, Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over 1 million royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. Their extensive library is royalty-free and demand-driven. What does that mean, Austin? Well, this is what it means, that they're constantly optimizing and adding to their 4K and HD footage, their After Effects stuff, their Premiere Pro templates, their music, images, SFX, etc., etc., etc. And remember, the assets are completely royalty-free, so you can use them both for commercial and personal use. So if you're a podcaster, if you're a short filmmaker, if you're making your first feature, if you're doing commercials, if you're doing YouTube videos, Insta videos, TikTok, whatever, if you need those extra spicy content elements, then you gotta head over to storyblocks.com/wisecrack, and you can learn all about what they've got to offer. That's storyblocks.com/wisecrack. You can learn all about the goodies. And of course, you can click the link down in the show notes too, if you would prefer. All right, back to the show. All right, let's do this. Let's just run headlong into the controversy that we've already stirred in the chat and that is dividing some people. All right, let's get outside.
I want to address an elephant in the room first.
Okay, elephant.
Ryan has the most beautiful spicy blue eyes right now. It looks looks like
sniffing that spice.
It looks like he just got back in from the desert or whatever.
How was it, man, Ryan?
Me and Zendaya, I think, would be a good couple. I agree with you, Raymond.
Okay, let's do this. Let's say the film is got, like, you know, pretty widespread acclaim. There are some people who just really fucking love this film, and other people who it didn't quite land for. Let's play devil's advocate. Well, I mean, it's not devil's advocate, but let's look at the other side. Why is this film getting so much love? Why do people, why are they so invested in the value, the beauty, the success of this film? What are people saying, and do you get that? Can we see from the perspective that is outside of our perspective and say, okay, I get why they love it so much?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is like you said, it's big Hollywood filmmaking on a grand scale, in a vernacular that we don't often see. Most movies of this budget are superhero flicks and stuff like that. And even though this is based on previous IP, it feels like a different flavor in the pop culture environment, which is why I want to reiterate, I'm very, very happy it's doing well, because that will probably open the door not only for sequels to this, but more movies of its ilk, and embolden studios to, like you said, Austin, take bigger swings rather than relying on not just IP, because once again, I know that this is an established IP, but it's still a weird movie. It's still a weird bet, you know? It's this weird political intergalactic thing with sandworms, and maybe it doesn't have enough sandworms for some of us, Ryan. But, you know, movies like this, when the first Star Wars came out and was a big hit, it launched a ton of imitators, some good, some bad, and hopefully the success of this film will maybe do the same. And I also don't think it hurts to have such a huge cast of recognizable stars. There aren't a lot of big star vehicles anymore. I always think of, like, the Marvel movies as being like Iron Man is the movie star in those movies, or Captain America is a movie star, but like Chris Evans may not necessarily be able to open a movie like Gifted based on the affection folks have for Captain America. Whereas this one, other than fans of the book, I don't think a lot of folks are coming into this thinking like, oh, you know, I really, really love these characters or this IP. You know, a lot of them are archetypes, and They're just brought to life by really great, compelling actors that have clearly endeared themselves to audiences. So I can see why it's doing well.
I would take your question and divide them up into the two different kinds of people who love this movie. And that's okay. The people who have read the book that love the movie and the people who haven't read the book. And I think that they like it for different reasons. I think that people who this story, Dune, you know, was famously one of those unfilmable novels for many years, right? Oh, how would you possibly make this? Everyone loves this story, but and it's so cinematic, but it's so dense. How would you ever make it into a movie? And the answer to that apparently is you don't. You make a fucking miniseries and you call it five movies or whatever the fuck is about to happen. But I think that a lot of people are just really getting off on the fact that, wow, somebody actually attempted and made a really awesome, decent, a passing Dune movie that is making a lot of money and people are liking and has big stars, you know? So I think that just the fact that it came out and is, you know, not as shitty as the David Lynch movie, which I know you praised at the beginning of this. Yeah. I think the David Lynch movie sucks even worse than this movie. I would give that, I'd give that a quarter of one star. All right. Cause it's literally incomprehensible and you can't follow it. And David Lynch has disowned it anyway. So I think that people are happy that they got this big movie and they probably would admit that it's not a perfect adaptation, but they think that it's got cool stuff going on, which it does. Like I said, it's got cool visual cinematic stuff going on for sure. And then the people who haven't read the book, like my brother loved this movie and he said he made our whole family promise to go see it in IMAX as soon as possible. And I think he liked it because of, you know, the cool way it was shot. He certainly wasn't like, oh, I loved it because of all the politics and getting into the motivations of the characters. I think that doesn't really come across on the first viewing of the film for somebody who hasn't read the book and knows these people. It really doesn't. And so I think that it's very much like, it's washing over him just as, wow, this is a cool universe and world that I'm being exposed to and in a different big way, in a, you know, big cinematic way. So I think that those are the two conversations we're having. And somebody in chat here said something that I think was very pertinent. They said, I feel like, Marianne said, I feel like this is a futuristic Pocahontas, right? Which, having seen the first movie, I guess I can kind of see how this is setting up to be kind of a Pocahontas story. So I think that's another reason it resonates with people very much in the same way that like Avatar did. It has these very broad universal themes, right? Of, you know, capitalism, colonialism, exploitation of cultures, you know, love, and then psychedelia from the 70s magic. And stuff, you know, magic. It's like all these things that, you know, they don't really even hammer down in the specific accessible ways, but it's just, The world is cool, you know? And so I think that that's another general reason why people gravitate towards this story. It's just the big, broad you know, themes.
So anyway, there's a lot to say about those themes too, right? With the extractivist economy, with the ecosystem. So Frank Herbert, who wrote the novel, he spent like 5 years actually studying environmental and ecological processes so that he could develop this really complex ecosystem on the planet Dune that then allows it to produce spice, right? Which then is extracted for the purpose of kind of like human, global, political, economic imperialism, right? So there's a lot of political themes and social themes and economic themes that are really rich in both the novel and in the adaptation. And so when you throw all those things up into a single piece, it allows people to kind of gravitate to the things that are important to them, right? And so you can see like, okay, so this is a beautiful cinematic space story, but that also has really important themes that we can gravitate to, even if they're kind of just subtly played. So we can talk a little bit about that, but I do want to ask this. So at one point, so my girl is in the biz as well, and she kind of turned to me at one point and she said, I wonder if this would have been better as a series. And Ryan, you just said that this is a mini series disguised as like a movie, right? And so I guess this is something that we can think about. Like, would this have been, because for her, she felt that it was a little, we were an hour in before she started really caring about the story, about the world, and then having any sort of concern about the characters, right? And so for her, she was like, I wonder if this would have been better if it were something like Game of Thrones, where you have an 8-part miniseries that allows you to kind of like really round out all of these different houses and all of these different things in the world, and then you can have the ecosystem be more kind of explored and things like that, right? There was a lot of stuff that was skimmed over in this first one, but that also really sets us up for, what, 2, 3, 4 more installments? So is it better to view this almost as a miniseries, or would it have been better if it were billed as a TV series? In just from a storytelling perspective, obviously you couldn't do the $150 million budget cinematic thing, and you probably couldn't have gotten some of the people involved, and so it wouldn't have looked the same. But do you think if you're going to be faithful to the novel and to the story, that it would be better served in a sort of longer form? Or is that actually what we're getting? It's just not billed that way.
I think it would have been better to get the Game of Thrones treatment, to have the super expensive, glossy, you know, big budget miniseries like Game of Thrones. And then a lot of people are pointing out in the chat that there was a series of Dune at some point.
Sci-fi, yeah.
And people think it's pretty good. But yeah, no, I absolutely think, I mean, as someone who has not read the book, so I'm not the fucking person who should be answering this question, it seems like after seeing part one of this, of the thing, that it would be better as served as a miniseries, so.
Yeah, I can't really speak to the efficacy of the adaptation in a miniseries versus a film diptych. You know, I think if anything, I didn't really have any issue with the pacing. It was just one of those things that, like I said, if you take issue with that stuff, I would just blame the marketing department. I think from the start, if they had just billed this as part one of Dune, it probably would have not rankled you so, Ryan.
Well, it also wouldn't have made as much money because everyone's going to go, shit, I don't want to go to part one, you know.
Maybe part two, baby.
Yeah. Wait till part two comes
Everyone
out.
Everyone waiting for a movie that they will 100% not understand.
Okay, let's start doing this. Let's start kind of like peeling back the film. Like I said earlier, I was really struck with like Tarkovsky vibes when I was watching this, the kind of slow, kind of like plotting, very sort of like the mysticism that was there. And even when it wasn't there, it felt like it was always kind of looming because it was always kind of like, what's going on here with this religious mysticism stuff? You know, and there's not much talk about like who these witches are and what their goal is and what they're trying to do. It's just like a lot of like really subtle hints about what they're doing. So I was thinking a lot about like Tarkovsky, and like he explores mysticism a ton, obviously, in his films. A lot of people are talking about Star Wars. A lot of people are talking about Lord of the Rings. What do you think? Like, what are the influences that kind of like create this film that when you see this, what were you thinking of?
One thing I wasn't thinking of, but after talking about it with my buddy Adam, he was like, did you get a bunch of Apocalypse Now vibes from the movie? I personally didn't, but he thought that the big fat uncle was like very much a Brando, Brando from Apocalypse Now kind of character send off. And then he sent me a podcast where Denny basically admitted such.
So very Heart of Darkness, anyway. Was that Villeneuve's
he definitely,
point?
Harkonnen definitely has some Colonel Kurtz vibes in this one. Whereas in the David Lynch one, he's just like flying around. He's like a giddy balloon man. It's I don't know. I think the reason that I bring up the David Lynch one as a point of comparison, obviously they're the same story. But I think that the reason I maybe enjoy that one a bit more is that it doesn't feel so serious. Like this movie, for all of its technical accomplishments, does feel very grim and kind of, I don't want to say monotone because that sounds pejorative, but there's not a whole lot of like characters other than being played by great actors who just have a natural sort of charm. They don't necessarily jump off the page at you. And I wonder, Austin, if you feel the same way when you're reading the book. Do the characters really grab you?
Yeah, they do, but that's because the characters have much more developed introspection. You get to learn about, like, Paul. He starts to develop these, like, powers where he can see past, present, and future and stuff like that, and you start to learn about this responsibility that he's bearing, but also how, like, he's like this messiah figure that has been anticipated, and so you start to learn more about the mythology and then his own kind of existential struggles with bearing the weight of that responsibility. It's kind of like a messiah. People in the chat are talking about like Anakin, you know, balancing the force kind of thing. I mean, it's a very familiar tale, right? It's the single person that is going to come and deliver us, right? The person that's going to deliver the people from their suffering, their exploitation, their oppression, whatever. And then how does a young person deal with the weight of that responsibility? You get a lot more of that in the novel than I think we are allowed to really linger over, even in a 2.5-hour film.
And with regards to this film's influences, I don't think we can disregard the fact that this is based on a novel that influenced a bunch of movies that maybe influenced Denis Villeneuve. It's one of those. I remember watching the John Carter movie, the Disney movie from forever ago that bombed, and watching it was like, oh, this movie feels like a ripoff of all the movies that were ripping off of the Edgar Rice Burroughs stories on which this movie is based. It's just one of those things where, because, like, you know, people are constantly synthesizing their inspiration and creating from a shared well of pop culture and literature and movies and what have you. This movie is like, it does. I think Denis Villeneuve is a great filmmaker. I think he has a really interesting vision regarding this, but I understand why people are saying, like, oh, it feels like Star Wars or it feels like Lord of the Rings. I mean, these books were undoubtedly influenced by Lord of the Rings, and then Star Wars was undoubtedly influenced by this book. Like, it's so difficult to you know, disconnect where the creative chain is.
I was just thinking, I was thinking Star Wars. I was thinking something like Tremors, like clearly the Shai Halud. Also, there's a great, great, great hardcore band called Shai Halud that you could check out. I was thinking about even something like The Matrix, where like there's this battle of the machines, even stuff like Terminator, right? Like there's this battle of the machines, and that's what happens in the novels, which we don't get a lot of in the film, right? But the novel has this war between like humans and robots, and then the humans win, and so they outlaw. A lot of people online were like, why are there no computers in this? And some people are like, because it was written in 1965. That's actually not the real answer. The real answer is that it's in the story that any sort of machine
people are
that
the
mimics,
computers because that, the machines are too dangerous.
That's right. And any machine that mimics human consciousness was outlawed. So that's the real reason. That's actually in the universe, right? So that's written.
That's crazy. I was about to bring that up too. Yeah. All right.
So that's the reason
why. Good to know.
Yeah, that's the reason why it's kind of like a stripped down technological world. So I'm thinking about, like, you know, all these films, Matrix, Tremors, Star Wars, fucking how many other, like, obviously the original Dune, how many fucking body horror films were then inspired?
I'm thinking Baywatch, because there's so much sand in it too. Like, in this
whole bunch of hunks.
That's right, just hunks walking around. So there's so much, right? And it is hard to find that kind of the creative causality, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think that's a negative. You know, everyone's ideas come from somewhere. Like, we're all just iterating and synthesizing our influences. And for what it's worth, like I said, I think Villeneuve does a great job with this film. He clearly has a sense of what he is trying to accomplish. He has a clear vision. And once again, I don't want to take anything away from folks who enjoy this, because for me, if I ever want to, you know, visit Arrakis again, I can watch the David Lynch one, and fans of this movie can watch this one. I don't see why everyone can't be happy about that.
Well, this is the great thing. I think a lot of people, we live in a world where we don't deal oftentimes very well with oppositions, like opposing viewpoints, right? And I don't want to talk about like fucking political stuff that like requires more serious engagement. I'm talking about like artistic preference, right? And we don't do well because I think we live in a world that it feeds us perpetual reinforcement over the things that we're already biased towards. And so we get trained to be kind of trapped in this world of positivity, that it's all got to be yes, 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 yes all the time. And so when we encounter a no, it's like, well, fuck you, that's a personal attack on me, rather than what I think. There's a wonderful way to be like, hey, look, I actually don't love this film, but I can sit there and I can sit with somebody and I can listen to their experience of this film, and I can be like, I see that, and I think that's super interesting that you think that. What if, and then I can take that idea, even though it's not my idea, and I can run with that idea, and I can work with that idea, and I can see how their idea that is literally opposed to my idea might have some sort of productive value for how I see the film or the piece of art or cinema more broadly or the social social landscape. And this is what's called like dialectical reasoning. And I would really
I
kind
thought
of,
you were going to say this is what's called having a pleasant conversation.
This is what's called having a pleasant conversation.
You're just breaking down basic like courtesy.
But honestly, so this is one of those interesting things because before we went into the record this, I was like, you know what? I'm not super excited to talk about this film because I'm not super excited about the film. But then I started to get excited about the themes of the film and the conversation that I knew we would have about the film. And I knew that that would change me somehow. And after this talk, I might now go revisit the film and it might mean something totally different for me. You know?
But since you mentioned that, since we're all kind of, you know, lukewarm on the film as a film, I mean, let's get into those themes. Like, you said that you didn't want to dive too much into political stuff, and I know that that can bog down some of the discussions on the show, but, like, this book is explicitly anti-imperialist. You know, I appreciate that aspect of it. There
well,
are some
spice
folks who
is
say
oil.
It's,
like spice
absolutely.
Is an analog for oil.
Iraq.
And the most interesting thing for me actually is there's a eugenics line, kind of conceptual through line in the novels that doesn't really get sort of highlighted so much here in the film, but it's about this idea of trying to create like a superhuman race of people or that people are
absolutely.
All affected a particular way in relation to the material resource of spice, which is very much about like the hegemony of global capitalism or the hegemony of like a singular world system. So there's a lot of that stuff in there as well.
I'm also curious because I do think that Denis Villeneuve, who is a very, in my opinion, a socially conscious filmmaker, I think a lot of his movies position him as like an extremely political filmmaker in the sort of post 9/11 mode. Like Sicario is obviously an explicit indictment of U.S. foreign policy. Prisoners right. is all about like the inefficacy of torture or enhanced interrogation. Whatever ghouls call that, like Enemy is about how inflicting trauma on others and inevitably boomerangs on the oppressor. And this
Arrival
movie
might be the best film on linguistics that I've ever seen.
Certainly. And there's also a great moment in Arrival that I think, you know, sums it up so well, which is where they're talking about how I think the spaceship that landed in China, the interpreters there are trying to talk to the aliens by using Mahjong. And I think Amy Adams at one point says like, oh, if you teach someone that language is about competition, which is essentially what they're doing, then you're essentially priming the pump for them to compete. And like, there is a sense of like how these things get lost in translation. But this movie, especially, I think he has an eye towards maybe some of the touchier aspects of the material. People have talked about how, you know, this movie is kind of like a white savior movie in the vein of like an Avatar or Dances with Wolves. But I'm not sure, having not read the book, but it seems like he is engaging with that critique in this movie by like showing how emotionally vacant all of these people are. Like they're all colonizers. They're all going to destroy this planet in one way or another. They're just fighting over the right to destroy the planet with each other. And like, you know, we even talked about Baron Harkonnen being depicted as kind of a Colonel Kurtz character in this. There's a scene in which he is like literally bathing in oil where he's emerging from it. So, you know, I just wanted to touch on some of that stuff really quickly because I know that our fans who listen to this show a lot of the time, not necessarily for us to say like thumbs up, thumbs down on a movie, but they do want us to talk about some of those headier themes or what the filmmakers are playing with subtextually.
Trey in the chat says Herbert was an old school conservative, pro-environmentalism and anti-communist. Did you get that vibe, Raymond, from the final product?
From this movie, I mean, I haven't read the book, so something may have been lost in translation. I know that watching this, there definitely seems to be an anti-imperialist message as far as the like corporate structure of the political structure of House Atreides versus House Harkonnen. Like, they both seem like fascist colonizers to me. So it's it would be tough for me to really to say how I felt about, like, you know, I don't think they ever get into like their the structure of their democracy. Like, I'm pretty sure they're just like monarchies, aren't they? You know.
It's kind of like medieval formulated.
Yeah, they're treating Arrakis as like a fiefdom. I think doesn't Oscar Isaac even say that at one point, that like this is my fief and blah blah blah, or am I thinking of a different thing that I watched recently? I can't remember.
Maybe.
I may be mistaken on that. I might have my wires crossed with a different book that I was reading or something. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean it's definitely. This version definitely leans into maybe more of a colonialist sentiment, which isn't something that we probably would have had in 1965. You know, post-colonial, anti-colonial theories really come at the end of the 1960s, really after 68. So 69, 70, that's when that really starts to become more of a thing. Not that people didn't have anti-colonialist or post-colonialist ideas, but it wasn't really in the forefront, but definitely imperialist, which is a little bit different maybe, right? But this is in the shadow of World War II and World War I. The world is kind of changing. It's also at the height of the Cold War. You've got like these two superpowers, right? And then the world was divided up in most people's minds between First World, Second World, and then Third World, right? Nations. So what you have here is this kind of, I could see how it would be anti-communist in the sense of anti-Soviet style communism at the time. And also at the same time, sort of a critique, if you will, a sort of like naturalist, environmentalist critique of the advancement of industrialization. So there's kind of like almost a primitivism that you get in this, which is this idea that the First Nations people or the native peoples, the indigenous peoples of Arrakis, they are the kind of oppressed, exploited, peripheralized, marginalized peoples. And then you get this kind of messiah figure who, one, you know, was kind of promised in their lore, in their mythology, but who could be like the white savior that kind of comes in. And he has to deal with that, right? Has to deal with, one, the responsibility of that. What does that mean? But also becoming kind of part of these peoples, learning from them. Remember, at first, you know, all we see right now is that Paul is allergic to spice. Right? Like he has these problems in this film. But as the story moves on, he learns to adapt to it and his powers grow as the story kind of unfolds a little bit more. So I think it's much more about like the tension of kind of moving through those spaces rather than it's very difficult to kind of take a 2021 mindset and kind of like reread that back into 1965. It's a little bit difficult. And then of course the Villeneuve version is going to be updated based on contemporary sensibilities.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I don't know. What else is on the outline? I mean, this is just one of those things where I feel like we're letting down, or at least I feel like I'm letting down the audience a little bit. You know, I don't want folks to think that.
How dare you not read a 1,500-page novel?
I should have, really. I read fucking Ready Player One to get prepared for that episode. That was one of the worst books I've ever read. But this, like I said, I would be interested in reading it and definitely be able to engage with those critiques a little bit more, having done so. But just engaging with the film as a film, I still think he's really thoughtful about his thematic deployment of the text that Frank Herbert gave him. And I wouldn't be surprised at all, considering how many movies he made before this that are like explicitly dealing with similar themes, like I mentioned before. I wouldn't be surprised if this book was just a seminal text for him growing up, in addition to being, you know, just one of his favorite books and a dream project of his to adapt. It really seems like it maybe molded his sense of consciousness as a person as well as a filmmaker.
One thing I do want to say, so DK in the chat a little while ago said that Villeneuve, even, you know, like this kind of goes back to the Apocalypse Now thing, you know, explicitly talked about this idea of going further into the wilderness. There's something, and I know it might seem like a hobby horse and it might seem like I'm forcing it, but I think we need to really see and think about like how important the Western mythology, and I mean like not Western as in global, but I mean as like cowboys, you know, firing guns and ranching and, you know, that type of Western, that type of myth is so important in the American psyche, you know, westward expansion, just this like manifest destiny, this open landscape that's just filled with possibilities and opportunities and things like that, is so kind of ingrained in the psyche that I see a lot of that even in Dune and in the Dune story. And you also get a lot of that in something like, I even think, in Apocalypse Now, where you get this idea that there's this radical bifurcation between civilization and technology and structures and societal formations and the wilderness and the wild. Now that can express itself in a couple of different ways. Sometimes, you know, the wild can be viewed as bad, right? As dangerous, as threatening, right? And then therefore the people of the wild, the indigenous, the First Nations peoples, whatever, they can be kind of demonized because of that. Or it can take the form, like it often does in the American Western myth, where that does happen as well. But it's also that the man, like, let's think about a film like The Searchers or Shane, you know, kind of classical Westerns. You have the man of violence that comes out of the wilderness, that comes in to build or rebuild society, but doesn't belong because they've learned violence. They've learned those ways that aren't accepted in this kind of quote-unquote civilized world. And that's kind of what you get with Paul here, but we're left to it at the end of the film where Paul, everything that he was raised with, right? His house, you know, this kind of like political allegiance that he believed he was a part of, right? All of that is taken from him, and now he's forced to go out into the wilderness. And now the question is does he then become the quote-unquote cowboy? Does he become the gunslinger? Does he become the man of violence, which you kind of see at the end when he kills the guy? He doesn't want to kill him. Remember, he's doing the practice on him, and he says, do you yield? And they're like, you can't do that. It's death is the only way here, right? So he kills him. Does he then change, and he can't ever go back to the kind of person he was before? Is this kind of something that's going on here?
I definitely think that killing someone is, I mean, they do make a big deal about that in this movie, you know, in reality as well. I imagine that taking someone else's life is something that changes you irrevocably. And, you know, what's her name? Queen Jessica? She done. There's like a handful of folks with just normal ass names, and those are
Paul, yeah, and Jessica,
but
and
I've got no problem remembering
Idaho.
Like, yeah, Baron Harkonnen or what have you. But then I've got to be like, is it Jennifer or Jessica? You know, they cut away to her, and she says, "Oh, he's never killed a person." Like, this is, as Josh Brolin says to him, you know, you fight when necessity makes you fight, and he is put in a point of necessity. But I do think that you bring up something interesting with regards to Western mythology. You know, you talk about, we've talked about on the show before how so many Westerns present indigenous folks as an obstacle to be overcome rather than like human beings who are being slaughtered and who are having their rights and their land taken from them. And this one, I can't speak to the book once again, but I do at least appreciate that the only people who are portrayed in a somewhat positive light are the Fremen or the free men, Frank Herbert. You know, like those characters clearly are the ones who are like, if not at peace with nature, they have like they've learned to adapt. They've learned to adapt to their world rather than attempting to break the world to their will. You know, I'm sure that's certainly what they get into with Paul kind of assimilating with them and adopting their ways. And in the David Lynch one, once again, haven't read the book, but I imagine that we've talked a little bit about how Zendaya is immensely underused in this film. I imagine the second film, she's a co-lead, and it's largely about her relationship with him as he learns to accept this planet and its culture and appreciate it and, you know, adopt it.
Mm. Ryan?
Yeah?
Chime in here, brother. What are some thoughts on this? You kind of gave it a one and a half stars, was it? What else, what else are you thinking? Yeah, what else are you thinking here?
Well, I you know, talking about like the indigenous aspect and stuff and how, you know, because I don't know what happens in part two. That's going to be a surprise to me. But it is interesting how he's straight up Do we believe that Paul believes that he's actually the Messiah, or is he just saying that to exploit these people, the Freemen, and say, oh, they have this Messiah story, and I kind of fit right in with that. You know, I should use that to get power. I mean, to me, that's kind of a very interesting, juicy aspect of the story of what's going on in his mind and what is going to happen to him, you know?
Yeah, somebody asked earlier in the chat, or said earlier in the chat, there was like, it's a Messiah who doesn't want to be, or rejects that it's a Messiah. And I would actually argue that that's the only position that is rational to be in, unless you're a megalomaniac. Like, any sort of messianic person can never accept that position of power, right? I would even argue that the quintessential Messiah figure from Christian and from monotheistic theology, let's say, because it's also in Islam as well and Judaism, right? That I would even argue that Jesus was a very unwitting messianic figure, and it's actually his followers that kind of uphold him.
A reluctant figure at times.
A reluctant figure, very much so. I think that any sort of messianic figure must kind of, in order to be a messianic figure, wrestle with that existential weight, wrestle with that responsibility. Like, how could you fucking, what are you talking about? How could I have this role that is meant to do this thing? And this is one of the really important themes throughout the series that, unfortunately, I haven't read to the end, but I've read lots of synopses and listened to lots of people talk about it, and it sounds really interesting, but that Paul really has to struggle with, even when his powers start to become greater and greater and greater, and he does get this ability to see past, present, and future all the time, he still isn't able to overcome. Just because you, and this is one of those great things about, if you have omniscience, do you have omnipotence as well? Well, Paul does not have omnipotence, right? He might be able to see past, present, and future, but does he have the capacity to stop these bad things? Does he have the capacity to intervene with wisdom or with prudence? Not always. And I think every messianic figure will always struggle with that.
Well, and it's crazy because usually in a messianic prophet-like figure, it's just kind of this divine thing that happens.
Right.
But, you know, you were talking about eugenics earlier, and it straight up seems like his mom is breeding him like a dog to become the Messiah.
that was the plan initially. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing. It's like, oh, we can just literally breed this Jesus figure out of us.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Austin, but what they talk about, how she was supposed to deliver a daughter, and that daughter was supposed to be coupled with a Harkonnen, right? And
so
that was supposed to like unite their families.
Exactly. And it has to do with these witches that I can't remember what they're called right now off the top of my head, but that have existed.
The Bene Gesserit.
Thank you. That have existed forever, and they're the ones who are crafting, if you will, the kind of superhuman that is supposed to come, or the superhuman.
Sure. The future of the species, essentially.
That's right.
I do know that, I'm pretty sure that that Denis Villeneuve said that he wants to do a trilogy. He wants to do Dune 1, Dune Part 2, and then he wants to adapt the second book, Dune Messiah, as like a closed trilogy. So, I mean, I would guess he has a lot of thoughts on the shape that Paul's journey takes beyond this book, even. So I don't know. 4 or 5 years from now, when the third movie is coming out, if we're still all doing this together, I'll be sure to read the first two books before we get on a call again.
I mean, what's the best Star Wars? It's number 2, right? So
yeah,
let's
the Attack of the Clones.
Yeah. So let's pump the brakes a little bit. Maybe number 2 will be, you know, The Empire Strikes Back. And what's the best Lord of the Rings? For me, it's number 2 and number 3. So, like, you know,
Ralph
Bakshi, baby.
Let this huge IP percolate a little bit. So yeah, okay, there's so much that we can explore. There are so many friggin' themes and concepts and ideas. We could talk about the filmmaking, all kinds of stuff, but we got to wrap up the discussion here. Let's just do this, though, because it's such a big topic, and it's so heated and so much in the kind of forefront of people's consciousness. Let's just do like a last thing. Like, Ryan, what is your biggest takeaway from this film? What is your...
Raymond...
Yeah.
I want Raymond to go first.
Okay, Raymond, you go first.
Sure.
So I can think about my answer.
No, I know my answer immediately. My biggest takeaway from this is I'm happy that after Blade Runner 2049 didn't do so hot at the box office, I'm happy that a great filmmaker, got another bite at the apple, and it seems like he's going to get quite a few more after the success of this film. And in addition to making a sequel or sequels to this, I hope that enables him to make the smaller but still very personal films of his that I've really enjoyed up to this point. So my big takeaway is I'm excited to see what Denis Villeneuve does next.
All right, Rye?
Mine is, I want more Sandworm, Denny. If you're listening to this, give me half of the movie as Sandworm, told from his perspective, please.
We'll always have Beetlejuice.
Also, yeah, like there's several movies that have the trope of like, oh, I'm seeing visions, right? You know, and then like later on, you see what the visions are made and stuff. I just think that that's a hard thing to pull off, and they don't do it very well in this movie, and especially, and they fucked up by baiting and switching everybody with Zendaya's part in this movie. She's in it for like 2 minutes of screen time in a 2.5 hour long movie. She's on the posters, and she's just the person that is, you know, this is a very nitpicky thing, yeah, because I really have no other big thoughts. I've kind of expressed them all here. I'm sorry, everyone, that I've been shitting on your favorite movie for an hour, but I can't help myself.
Yeah, I think that it was a home run swing, like I said, and it just got caught at the warning tracks, but you know what? Give me a home run swing every single freaking time. If more movies come out that are like this, that I don't think work perfectly well, but that are in that 2.5 to 3 star range, but I can't stop talking about it, or people are talking about it, or they've done something beautiful technically, give us that until I freaking die, and then into the next generations and next generations, please.
And so, I would say the same thing. Another movie that I wasn't crazy about, Tenet, I still love seeing filmmakers get to take big risks. And Two thumbs up for pure cinema, if nothing else.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Fuck yes.
And give us more Tremors. Whoever owns the rights to Tremors.
Yeah, also
I feel like we're going to have to do Tremors
part 5 and 6
podcast.
And 7 for Riley's.
Right, right off of the success of Dune, please.
Let's wrap up the Dune chat, and let's get into a voicemail just so that we can talk a little bit about Squid Game, because everybody was writing to us and calling us about Squid Game. Remember, you can call us and leave a voicemail at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. And leave us a voicemail. If you can, keep them quick. 30 seconds or less, so that we can make sure we address them. But if you do have some longer thoughts, of course, you can also email us, movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. Let's run that voicemail.
Hey-o, I just listened to the Squid Game episode, and I'm wondering if you guys think that there's any thematic significance to them being children's games, other than just like the aesthetic aspect of like, oh, this is cool and freaky. And also, I've been thinking that this show would be easily adaptable to make an American season, in which the games take place in America with an all-American cast and crew. And I was wondering if you guys think that's a possibility in the future of the show. Thank you.
All right, so for those of you who are watching the live stream, you'll see that Ryan removed his earphones right now. And that's because... No, Ryan removed his earphones because... because he doesn't want spoilers. So we're going to real quick...
I haven't seen Squid Game yet, and everyone, I can't wait to see it. I don't want it spoiled for me.
Okay,
so sorry.
So we just listened to the voicemail, so we're gonna answer the voicemail here. I'm going to tap my earphones when you can put your earphones back on, Ryan. So take your earphones off.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So, Raymond, what do you think? What's the significance of them being children's games, and do you think there can be an American adaptation?
I think there is something interesting going on with the fact that they're children's games. On one hand, it's very easy to entice people into the fold that way and get them overconfident about their abilities in it. And it's a way of... we got an email from a listener as well. I'm sorry we didn't have time to read it. And I'm sorry I don't have their name on hand. But they talked about how it's this sort of infantilizing aspect of the culture that... You know, it's they're stopping just short of popping a pacifier in their mouths when they start dying on the field.
Yeah.
As far as an American remake is concerned, I could see it going one of two ways. This show was so incredibly successful, you could see them wanting to greenlight an American remake tomorrow. But on the other hand, the show was so incredibly successful, it's like, well, we've already tapped that audience. I think the reason that this show is connecting with so many folks globally is because it has universal themes, capitalism, exploitation,
poor, inequality. Yeah,
absolutely. The degree to which it's connected with American audiences, I think we can relate to that stuff here, obviously. So I think, as is so often the case, an American remake would be an essential. But if it can help this show find an even bigger audience, yeah, why not?
Yeah, I don't think that there will be an...
He's checking his emails now. He's not even...
Come on. Oh, yeah. I'm just going to say, real quick, Ryan, I'm just going to say, I don't think there will be an American remake, but I do think it's going to inspire a lot of American... ripoffs, right? You know, kind of like Cube inspired a kajillion other Cube like things. I think
Battle
there's gonna be
Royale,
like
Hunger Games, game show. Cube. All this stuff is already in the ether, so who knows?
Yeah, it's just gonna be more of that stuff. Okay, now Ryan, what are your anticipations for Squid Game? What have you heard about this? Why are you protecting your ears so stridently here? Like what's going on?
Well, look, all I know, the only thing I know is that everyone on Earth seems to love it and that it's very much like Battle Royale or one of those you got to kill everyone to the last person kind of thing. And as someone who is literally wearing a Battle Royale t-shirt fan in the world of stuff like that, I love any Battle Royale. We'll just call it the Battle Royale genre. I love the whole Battle Royale genre, including Hunger Games.
Do you like the Royal Rumble?
I don't love Hunger Games, but I think it's fun enough.
The Royal Rumble as well, like in WWF back in the day? Was that your... That was my thing.
Oh, yeah. The conceit of one man only will survive. You know, that's why I fucking love Survivor, which I'm literally going to be watching tonight. You know?
It's also why you love Highlander, you were telling me.
Yeah. There can only be one. I mean, I just think it's always fun. You know, that's why I like sports. You know, there can only be one person that wins the Super Bowl. It's just a fun, dramatic story. What did somebody say? Sports is like... unscripted drama or something like that. Anyway, and I know Squid Game is scripted, but just there can be only one is a fun story.
Or as that famous bumper sticker that I used to see in Orange County all the time used to say, "He who dies with the most toys wins." All right.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, speaking of infantilizing people.
All right. As I said, if you want to call, you can call us with your questions, your thoughts about Dune, Squid Game, anything from our back catalog, please do at 1-213-534-8807. Of course, you can email us, movies@wisecrack.co. We're so backlogged with so many things that people have written to us or called in about that we're actually going to be doing just an entire mailbag episode at some point in the near future here. So don't feel so don't feel like if we're not getting to your question that we won't tackle it. We will. We're just going to fucking sit down and we're going to address everything that you're bringing to us. So 1-213-534-8807 or movies@wisecrack.co. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter, SMTM_POD. We've also got Culture Binge and we've got Squanch and we've got all of our other podcasts on the Wisecrack Network that you got to go check out. I think that's pretty much it. Patreon. Make sure to go to patreon.com/wisecrack.
Yes, of course.
And check us out if you want access to bonus content. Raymond and I did a topic a few weeks ago where we did an extended chat about Apocalypse Now, and we're actually just about to record another one about the philosophy of acting. We're going to be talking about acting, what's good acting, what's bad acting, what inspires actors, etc., etc. So we're going to record that very soon here. All right, that's patreon.com/wisecrack. Let's get out of here. Where can people find you on the internet, Raymond?
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria, and this week I have something to plug as well. I joined our friends over on When Cinephiles Attack to talk about Mike Flanagan's Midnight Mass on Netflix, and that podcast just dropped today. So I wasn't on the Squid Game episode, but if you want to hear me talk about a different Netflix miniseries, we had a really great conversation about Midnight Mass, so check out When Cinephiles Attack in the podcatcher of your choice.
Everybody has said that Midnight Mass is like theological horror, and it is absolutely something I need to see. So don't say anything about it. I'm not going to listen to the podcast.
I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Because I don't want a spoiler, but I have to see that because everyone tells me it's amazing. All right, Ryan.
Yeah, you can find me at Ryan's Game Show on Twitter and Ryan Shorts on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and all that shit, and release comedy videos there. I'm about to record the end of a video about how to make homemade guacamole, which should be very interesting. Obviously, and I recorded my last one was a song about the day Friday, a la Rebecca Black.
Before that, you learned a beautiful piece on piano there as well.
Oh, yeah, with Jason D. Williams, the illegitimate child of Jerry Lee Lewis.
Exactly how he wants to be introduced.
Amazing. And if you want, you can find me. My name's Austin Hayden. You can find me on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, Insta, AUS_HAY. Let's get out of here, Ryan. Send us out, brother.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California. This has been Show Me the Meaning. Let's do some spice!